This is the Climate Ambassador Podcast. Listen, learn, and get empowered.
You're very welcome to today's Climate Ambassador Podcast, discussing a topic that is probably on everyone's mind, energy. Hello, my name is Gary Terrell, and we are joined by Hannah Daly, Professor in Sustainable Energy and Energy Systems Modelling at University College Cork in Ireland. Hannah's research and lecturing focuses on modelling and developing sustainable pathways for the energy system, encompassing energy access, climate change and air pollution. Hannah also writes blogs and has a regular column in the Irish Times. Hannah, thank you for joining us. It's great to chat with you today.
Thank you, Gary.
I was wondering if you could start by giving us a bit of background on yourself, Hannah, and you know, how did your journey lead to where you are now?
Sure, I suppose like every journey, it's everyone's journey. It's been a fairly idiosyncratic. So I actually originally studied maths in UCC. You know, as a teenager, I just liked maths. Didn't have any particular agenda about what I wanted to do. Wasn't really thinking about the outside world that much, and I was very lucky when I was in third year of college, I got a scholarship to study abroad in the University of California in Santa Cruz. So I actually took an extra year to kind of between my third and fourth year, because I couldn't kind of finish up my undergraduate studies through that. And I basically got to take a whole selection of different modules and courses in UC Santa Cruz. It's a very sort of environmentally conscious campus. It's amazingly placed. It's basically set into a redwood forest overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And there was a lot of kind of really environmental consciousness on campus. There were even tree sitters. So there was protests among students about kind of removing some of the trees for a car park. And that kind of, you know, and also the academics and professors, a lot of them, courses that I took were very progressive environmentally and socially. So I took one class called Blood and Oil, which gave this whole sort of geopolitical history of the oil industry. It was at the time of the Iraq War. It introduced kind of climate change, and I took some other modules on sustainable development that also covered, you know, environmental impacts of the energy system. And I just found it fascinating. You know, we kind of take our energy system for granted and our sources of energy for granted, but it sort of permeates everything that we do. And at the time, I realized that climate change is really going to be something that's going to define kind of, you know, the global agenda for my whole life and probably for generations to come. So I decided at that point to kind of dedicate my career to that. I remember at one point thinking, God, how can I have children and fly and, you know, all these things while being aware of all that? And I still struggle with that. And I decided sort of almost in compensation for all that to try to dedicate my career to helping kind of put my shoulder to the wheel and helping to address these problems. So it started from there. And I suppose a brief history kind of after that, I did a PhD in energy policy and modelling in UCC. I was very lucky that kind of a new research group was being set up that basically applied mathematical modelling tools to understanding the impact of policies on energy and on climate change within Ireland. So that was a very good experience. That was the time of the recession as well. So I was lucky to get that funding to do the PhD. And then I graduated in 2012 and went to UCL in London, which was another great experience. Worked on kind of UK policy modelling and following that, I went to Paris to the International Energy Agency, and now back in UCC where I could work on really national climate policy issues.
Amazing. And it really strikes me, going through other podcasts as well and chatting to people like yourself, Hannah, like the power and importance of education and how, like, you know, one module or one lecturer can really spark off something in people and kind of change their whole career paths. You know, it's amazing to hear that.
Absolutely. And I take that with me very strongly when I now, you know, lecture various modules. I suppose the most significant class I teach is called Sustainable Energy to about 100 undergraduate and postgraduate students. And I really try to put a lot into that. And, you know, despite all the various kind of engagements I have at the national and global level, I actually feel like that is my kind of biggest contribution. You know, and a lot of students aren't aware of how, you know, I think everyone understands in the background how serious climate issues and various other kind of sustainable energy issues are. They cover energy access, energy poverty, air pollution, energy security and development and so on, as well as climate change in that course. And I, like I always think like if there's one student every year who I kind of really impact, then you know that can really have big kind of ripple effects. And so I do take that seriously. And I often keep in touch with that professor from Blood and Oil in Santa Cruz and let him know what I'm up to. So he also knows his impact on, yeah.
That's brilliant. And I'm sure there's more than one per year, Hannah. The students are lucky to have you. So you touched on the energy crisis already, Hannah, and just, you know, it's been mentioned in media everywhere all the time. Undoubtedly, the war in Ukraine has had a major part to play, but prices were rising before the invasion began in February of 2022. I'm just wondering, could you outline why the energy costs have spiraled so much over the last year with record profits for energy providers? And, yeah, you know, what do you think should be done to address this issue?
Yeah, there's like this, I think the latest report from the International Energy Agency, from the organization that I used to work with, just shows that is it $2 trillion excess profits that fossil fuel producers have made this year, which is just astounding. You know, you kind of say that the energy transition is expensive, but you know, fossil fuels are by far the most expensive thing. You know, who can afford oil and gas anymore? So I'm not able to kind of succinctly, I suppose, summarize any single cause for what was causing the general price inflation. It is like it's always a combination, you know, of market dynamics of supply and demand, and the IEA would have said that there's underinvestment in fossil fuel production, due to a number of factors to meet the demand that's there. So there's limited investment in producing fossil fuels, but the demand was still growing strongly, especially after COVID. Energy demand rebounded strongly in Asia, and economic growth took off again. So when you get that mismatch between demand and supply, and basically what that means is that we're not building out the alternatives quickly enough. I mean, if you look at the trajectory for how much the world needs to invest in fossil fuels, we're underinvesting relative to what the demand is, but it's the right level of investment for what the demand should be given our climate commitments, you know. But the problem is that we're not building up the alternatives quickly enough. So as a result, there's a supply squeeze, prices go up, and importing countries then pay a really disproportionately high amount. And unfortunately, then that promotes more investment in energy production. So I think Christiana Figueres called it a piñata. You know, this is just a gold mine that anyone with fossil fuel resources just wants to exploit because prices are so high. The profit margins are extraordinarily high because, you know, a country who's producing oil at, you know, $5 a barrel is now getting, you know, $60, $70, $80 a barrel, and they keep that excess profit. You know, their costs for extracting don't go up. So all that means is that instead of kind of prolonging fossil fuels and that imbalance, you know, governments need to invest in clean energy and to accelerate the energy transition and also move away from our high energy dependence in the first place, because it's not enough to just replace like for like with renewables and electrification. We also need to think a lot more carefully about what we need energy for. You know, we're an extraordinarily energy dependent society and economy. You know, we can't do anything without energy, and we should be able to organize ourselves to need less energy. And that's something that we need to prioritize. A lot of the research I do focuses on demand reduction.
Yeah. And, you know, really highlights as well, like there's so many benefits from renewables. It's not just about, you know, getting cleaner air and stuff like that. It's you know, some really solid economic reasons too. I just wonder what your thoughts are then as well. You know, we've heard talk about caps on profits for energy providers and also decoupling gas from electricity markets. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on those two points.
Yeah, it's been highlighted a lot as a potential kind of way of alleviating the pressure on households. In Ireland alone, we don't have huge levers to enable this because household bills are high because the global price for gas is high, effectively. Mm. And so, you know, these excess profits are not largely being made in Ireland. They're being made by the countries that we import gas from. So Qatar, the US, Norway, and so on. And so we don't have, like, you know, they're out of our jurisdiction, so we can't, you know, we can't tax them. I mean, some renewables producers, so any of the electric utilities, they the market price for electricity is set by the most expensive producer, which is gas. And so some of the electric utilities, you know, ESB and so on, who also have a generation portfolio, let's say in selling wind energy to the grid, they would be making excess profits from that. And there has been, a planned cap in those profits to fairly redistribute those to households, which is all fair. You know, I mean, it has to be really important that we're all in it together and that no producers aren't soaking up. Otherwise, you know, there'll be a resentment towards renewables, rightly so. But I think we have to manage our expectations about how much actual money that will deliver. It's limited enough, and it's quite complicated as well, because some companies have not actually been passing on the kind of highest electricity price to households that they would have hedged, and they would have kind of used some of those excess profits to kind of offer more competitively priced tariffs to consumers. So effectively, households might not be seeing that those huge bills that they would have if companies were actually passing on those profits. All that is to say that it's important to make sure that there's a fair balance of profit, but also that the renewables industry, is still strong and viable, because that's our strongest way out of this, is to and to prevent these excess bills in the future. I mean, people say that, you know, oil and wind and solar are intermittent, but you know, they're actually far. We know what the price intermittency is, as dangerous as supply intermittency here. And we know with a lot more certainty what the price of wind and solar is. It's coming down hugely, and it's now far, far cheaper than fossil fuels. And also it's money spent in the country on jobs and economic kind of growth here. So that was a bit of a rambling way to say it's complicated.
Yeah. No, not at all. No, absolutely. And like, you know, the price of renewables are never going to be impacted by the war in the Ukraine, you know, for example, like the way, you know, things are with gas and all of that. So, yeah, no, great point. Kind of sticking on that kind of theme, like with the energy credits of €600 that were announced in the recent budget for households, while electricity will be 10% more expensive during the peaks of 5 to 7pm for large industry and data centres, with the hope of to encourage more businesses to switch to smart meters. There's also talk of avoiding blackouts, but with a risk of such remaining for the foreseeable future. So, you know, smart meters are due to be installed in every home by 2024 to allow greater visibility of energy use and prices, again, with the hope of moving away energy use from peak demand, you know, putting less strain in the system and helping to avoid blackouts. I'm just wondering, what is the bottom line here with regard to blackout risks, do you think? How real is that risk, and what can we do to reduce that?
Yeah, it's a very real risk. So because the capacity market in our electricity system hasn't really delivered enough, unfortunately, what we need is fossil fuel generators, you know, thermal generators, to be able to keep the lights on at times when it's not windy and demand is high. That capacity market has failed. So the margin between like what demand could be and supply can actually achieve is very thin. We had a number of kind of failed power generators the last number of winters, which put us on very thin ice. I understand that this winter it would take a big confluence of events, a very unlucky confluence of events to actually make blackouts. You're talking about, you know, no wind, high demand, maybe interconnector from the UK not operational, and some unexpected outages from our thermal operators. It is possible, but I think large energy users like data centers have been instructed that they'll in that circumstance they'll need to switch to their own generators or power down. Now, of course, that creates a conflict with our emissions targets, and you know, unfortunately, greenhouse gas emissions are still rising in the power sector. And that is because we're not building out renewables quickly enough, and demand is rising faster than renewables can keep up with. And the solution to that is, you know, there's lots of different things that we need, but we need to accelerate the energy transition, not just for climate reasons, but in a way to promote energy security and alleviate energy poverty and kind of the inaffordability problems. This is the so-called energy trilemma, which is energy affordability, security, and environmental sustainability. And I think 2022, I can't think of any other time when this energy trilemma was so shaky. You know, all three pillars of it are really on the rocks at the moment. And something that we did recently, a report for Friends of the Earth to look at the energy security of supply review in the context of our climate commitments. It's really clear that we have to be very careful not to take measures to address one of those things, like, for example, energy security by building, let's say, an LNG terminal and then exacerbate one of the other problems. You know, LNG, for example, would not alleviate energy bills and it would exacerbate, you know, our climate challenges. And it potentially would be a very costly mistake, given that we need to wind down gas usage. Very careful policymaking is necessary. Another example of we'll say, one of the knee-jerk reactions to the high, maybe knee-jerk is unfair, but, you know, kind of like a quick reaction to those high prices at the petrol pumps that came earlier this summer when we saw petrol and diesel go over €2 a litre. The government dropped the excise tax on those very quickly. It'll be very hard for government politically to bring those back. And it was, you know, it dampened that response that might have seen people drive less. I mean, they could have alleviated that through, for example, some more energy credits to poorer households, which would have been kind of more fair way of doing that. But it just shows that you know, energy policy making is, you know, there's lots of unintended knock-on consequences unless things are done very carefully.
Yeah, and fossil fuels accounted for almost 86% of all energy used in Ireland in 2020. In regard to renewables, mostly onshore wind, Ireland has actually done quite well, where renewables accounted for 35% of all electricity generated last year, down from a high of 42% renewables and electricity in 2020. The Climate Action Plan, which you mentioned there, has increased the target for renewable electricity up to an ambitious 80% by 2030. Meanwhile, the government is right now preparing its next Climate Action Plan, which will detail policies and measures needed to meet these emissions cuts as well. So I'm just wondering, how will we achieve this 80% renewable energy target, do you think? And what should be included in the Climate Action Plan to meet the emissions cuts as well?
Yeah, so it's hard to summarize when there's sort of no easy answers. Yeah. It's like a lot of different measures are necessary, and, you know, there's no easy way out. There's no silver bullets. Like, they all have to be done, and we know what has to be done. You know, it's fairly simple to say what's necessary. It is deploying a lot more renewables, solar, onshore wind, and then offshore wind when we get the market ready as quickly as possible. And reduce demand, and also to make the electricity system far more flexible, so that, you know, demand can meet supply when there is wind there, and that we can use storage to kind of shift the renewables from when they're generated to when they're needed. But, you know, it's easy to say what's necessary, but it's much harder to implement those. So, you know, I think the Climate Action Plan, I think the timing of these targets also has to be looked at, because, you know, the key thing that our carbon budgets measure and limit is greenhouse gas emissions, and not just in the power sector, in all sectors. And the power sector is worth only, I think, is around 15% of our kind of national greenhouse gas emissions. So it's small in terms of in terms of a sector, but it's actually the most important means of decarbonizing transport, heat, and industry. So that's how we'll kick a lot of fossil fuels out of those systems, is by electrifying them. So that's where, you know, the power system has to not only decarbonize itself, it also has to decarbonize the other energy using sectors. So it's really important that we get that right. And it's really important that we don't just have a mindset of, you know, 2030 clean energy deployment. So, you know, we typically, when we think about the Climate Action Plan measures, we think about, you know, how many electric cars will there be in 2030, or how many, you know, how much solar will there be in 2030. We actually have to move away from that mindset more and think about greenhouse gas emissions on an annual basis, including in this year. Like, right now, greenhouse gas emissions are kind of on a pathway to exceed our carbon budgets, because the carbon budgets place a quota on total emissions starting from 2021. That's last year. So we're more than one third of the way through the first carbon budget. And the more that we emit now, you know, the more we'll have to kind of remove emissions later on, or we'll have to cut emissions later on. We can't really, there's no really way of removing emissions. I use that word incorrectly. So that's again a fairly rambling way of saying we need to kind of accelerate a lot of those targets, not just think about what we do in 2030. We have to think about how quickly we can get measures on. So we have to think about measures that we can deploy very quickly. And I think, for example, solar energy is something that we can deploy a lot faster than is being targeted. If we just think about deploying maybe a few gigawatts of solar PV by 2030, it's not really ambitious. You know, what the Climate Action Plan will hopefully be looking at is how quickly we can get solar panels on as many rooftops as possible, so that can bring down energy bills and make people feel like they're part of the solution, which I think is a very important measure as well, giving people sort of a tangible action that they can take that has clear win-wins.
Yeah.
So it'll be about implementing accelerated, immediate kind of deployment of these things. So that's offshore wind will later this decade be a major infrastructure project. It'll be, you know, it's been called the biggest infrastructure project in the history of the state. And there's a kind of hope that we can export a lot of that and make, you know, I don't know, people have compared us to the Saudi Arabia of wind, which, you know, I don't think we need to use that analogy, but, you know, we have huge wind resource. And the question will be how we can make best use out of that. That will be something that comes later this decade. There's a lot of interest, but there's a lot of basically institutional change and policy change that needs to happen, and infrastructure development that needs to happen before we can make best use of that. I'll give a quick run through of what needs to happen before we can have meaningful offshore wind. We don't have the ports to build it. So the only port on the island that can kind of assemble and bring these things out is in Belfast. So we need, you know, a port, especially on the Western seaboard, to make use of the Atlantic resource. We need a modernized grid. So our grid actually, you know, can't handle that kind of capacity. So, and that will need a lot of public support to be able to build pylons and cables, you know, to bring electricity from the renewable resource to where it's needed. We need a kind of a better, more functioning planning system so that the public has trust in the planning system, and also environmental groups have trust in it, that, you know, we're not just going to steamroll kind of environmental laws and put these things out with urgency. We need both to do due diligence for environment and also to have urgency. So I think there's a kind of planned reform of the planning system, which hopefully will deliver on both of those things. Right now, the time that it takes for an offshore wind developer to get planning permission here and grid access is far, far too long, and they can get it much faster in other countries which also have good wind resource. So we need to make this an easy place to build renewables, you know, while ticking all the right boxes in terms of environmental credentials and so on. That third point of making the grid a lot more flexible and agile is really important as well. And what that means is kind of rolling out tariffs to make sure that people with smart meters can get the right signals, that they can save a lot of money by, let's say, you know, using appliances at nighttime when prices are lower and emissions are lower as well. So there's big win-wins there. You know, I have a smart tariff at the moment and I have an electric car. And, you know, you don't need massive technology for this. I just set the EV charge timer for 2 o'clock in the morning when I have really, really cheap electricity. I pay for that with really, really expensive electricity between 5 and 7 p.m., which I've kind of decided as a trade-off because I can get really cheap kind of EV charging. I think twice about putting on the oven at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, just with all of that stuff, like it's there's a lot to be done. It's exciting to think of what's going to come in the future. And like that, you know, when we have, like, you know, 9/10 of our sovereignty is offshore, you know, in our waters, and, you know, we really could provide a lot of energy for the rest of the country. But for the rest of Europe, sorry. But I just going back to the solar panel point that you raised. Like, I got solar panels installed myself this year, PVs, and it's been brilliant just to feel like now, you know, that small contribution that I'm making towards, you know, for the grid and for myself, and even just talking to neighbours and stuff, and how some of them are surprised, going, oh, like, you know, they didn't think solar panels were really viable in Ireland, you know, whereas, you know, what's 80% of the solar power from places like Barcelona we can get here in Dublin, you know, over the year, and with all the daylight that we get. So, you know, yeah, things like that is you know, the all these steps together help as well. But just with regards to the, if you're kind of touching this a little bit already, with regards to the gas electricity generator plants as backup for renewables, you know, when the sun's not shining, the wind's not blowing, you know, although gas is a lesser evil than burning peat or coal or even oil for electricity, it's still a fossil fuel. And, you know, this is an area I'm sure you've heard some voices give different opinions on this. Do you think will fossil gas generators be needed if we had 80% renewables in 2030, for example?
Yeah, we looked at in detail at this for this report for Friends of the Earth, as I mentioned, and the report found really we do kind of urgently need new gas-fired generating capacity. So we need, you know, again, to kick off Money Point and the oil to replace the kind of the older kind of more retiring gas plants. And also as this flexible alternative for, you know, to supply electricity in times of need. But the report also found that we need to half our use of gas. So while we need new gas plants, we actually need to use them for far less time than they're currently being used. Otherwise, we'll exceed our carbon budgets. And that's going to be a challenge, but I'm confident that it can be done. Technically, it can be done. And what that requires is a combination of, again, like I said, building out renewables much faster, building out those kind of demand flexibility and storage to make best use of the renewables. The interconnector to France, I didn't mention, maybe we should be building several more of those. Right now we've got one, the Celtic interconnector is signed, but maybe we should be thinking about doing more so that we can kind of export electricity when it's windy and importing when it's not as one source. And then, of course, managing electricity demand as well. And the report certainly found that additional data center demand, which is our really strongest growing, very huge, power hungry kind of source of industry, electricity demand, that will put huge pressure on the power grid to deliver on its carbon budgets, because simply data centers will promote more fossil fuel generation.
Yeah, just on that, with data centers, as you know, like 14% of the electricity grid is for data centers in Ireland now, which is more than all of Ireland's rural homes put together. Airgrid, Ireland's electricity grid operator, have said that data centers could rise to up to 30% by 2030. Whereas globally, normally electricity consumption levels from data centers is typically around 1%. You know, we definitely need data centers to run any tech gadgets that most of us use every day. But the numbers in Ireland are quite staggering, aren't they? Is this sustainable, do you think?
No, I mean, unfortunately, I mean, I don't want to come here kind of demonizing the big tech kind of industry. They chose to locate here because the government's enterprise strategy from a number of years ago decided to specialize in data centers, making these arguments that we were kind of a good place to host them and that they are consistent with our kind of tech industry economic structure. But unfortunately, that just didn't take into account the vulnerabilities of our energy system and of our climate commitments. We don't have a particularly clean electricity grid, for example, even though we have high ambitions to become more clean. There are many other countries that have kind of a lower carbon electricity grid that also are a good location for data centers. And they are genuinely putting a big strain on emissions. I mean, again, they're about 14% of a sector worth about 15% of our emissions. So in absolute terms, they're not a huge kind of source of greenhouse gas emissions, but they will put strain on the grid in a number of ways. And I mean, it's certain that if we continue on the sort of high electricity demand path from data centers, it's very difficult to see how we'll manage to decarbonize not just the electricity system, but be able to spare enough electricity to kind of decarbonize homes, transport, and other industry as well. This is where I've highlighted the really need to think about the sustainability of enterprise strategy. From an energy point of view, we need to kind of think about how the economy grows in a way that's consistent with national climate ambition and also global climate ambition, because there's, I'm sure, a lot of things that are kind of economic or various industries could pivot towards to be kind of part of the clean energy transition, whether that's kind of manufacturing components of wind turbines or of electrolyzers to make hydrogen or making sustainable aviation fuel from our wind energy and so on. I think we need an economic and employment growth strategy that's consistent with that and that can make best use of the global energy transition, which is really accelerating at pace.
Yeah, wow. I'm just kind of staying on that, kind of looking towards the kind of future a bit. Like Moneypoint is Ireland's largest electricity plant, and a full capacity that can consume 7,000 tonnes of coal per day, which is about 2 million tonnes a year. And now these ESB have said Moneypoint is due to cease burning coal by 2025, and the site is to be transformed into a green energy hub where a range of renewable technologies will be deployed over the next decade, with the capacity to power 1.6 million homes. It sounds really exciting. I know there's plans there for floating offshore wind farms, a wind turbine construction hub, and investment in green hydrogen production, storage and generation facility. You know, I'm just wondering, how are all these plans progressing, do you know? And considering we have increased coal burning at the plant again this year, will the current energy crisis delay these plans, do you think?
Yeah, any additional coal burning from Moneypoint is really going to put our carbon budgets out of reach. And I think the government has recognised that. And the latest reports I've heard from Daniel Murray in the Sunday Business Post is that there's plan to convert burners in Moneypoint to oil, which of course is a fossil fuel again, but it is kind of, I think there's about 20 to 30% emission saving. But most of all, it can be, it's really important because of our generation gap, our capacity gap, that we have a kind of a storable source of energy that, that can be turned on if necessary. And so I can see the rationale for converting that to oil, because we can simply store a lot more oil. We can't store any gas, and coal is the big baddie for emissions. So, you know, this is one of these like not ideal steps. Hopefully it'll be sort of a short-term emergency measure rather than any kind of, you know, we really don't want to be burning oil. We want to be using that using gas as a last resort. But oil will be the very last resort in that case. But then as for, yeah, using Moneypoint as a hub for clean energy, I think that's very exciting. You know, I mean, I can get behind that far more than, let's say, an LNG terminal on the West Coast. And I think there's huge potential for the Western Seaboard to be, you know, a real hub of innovation for clean energy. You're talking about hydrogen, electrofuels, you know, batteries and system services like these synchronous condensers that keep the electricity grid going without burning anything. And I was at COP27 in Egypt a few weeks ago. Went to a fantastic panel discussion with Mary Robinson. You know, she's really inspiration. And something that she said really struck me. She said, the best years are ahead of us. Can you imagine an energy system without fossil fuels, without even burning anything? I mean, that is something that I think should be used as a societal mission. You know, you talked about, you know, solar panels on your own house. I mean, I don't know why we're not sort of kind of spreading that kind of really positive message to people. You know, we're used to hearing all these dark things about the Ukraine war, about climate change and so on. But there are things that people can do. And people, if they understand and get behind this, I think that there's huge potential to kind of tap into that vision for a post-fossil fuel society, which I think is very hopeful and very possible.
Yeah. And it's isn't it wonderful to think of it, and the multi benefits that come with that, like you were talking about, like energy security, stable prices, clean air, clean water, more jobs. Like there's so many things, you know, before you even think about, you know, climate change. So, yeah, no, that's a great thought. I love that post fossil fuel society. But just looking at space and water heating, as you know, that takes up a large chunk of our domestic energy bills, which can total up to 80% of an average Irish home's annual energy costs. Our heating needs depend on fossil fuels for 96% of consumption levels. And, you know, just going back to that, what you're talking about, electrifying heating as much as we can. What heating solutions do we need to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels? And I'm wondering, can you outline where some of these solutions might help both with the housing and climate crises?
Sure. And we have a very kind of carbon intensive heating relative to the rest of Europe. So we've got kind of drafty houses, a coldish climate, and we rely on very carbon intensive fuels to heat our homes. So starting with the worst, peat and coal are still used in a large number of houses. And then oil is very carbon intensive as well. We also have large houses. All these things kind of add up to high energy bills, high emissions, and fuel poverty, which we also are experiencing a lot. I think estimates around 30% before even this 2022. So people can't heat their homes adequately. And that creates both discomfort and just generally poor quality of life, but also health problems. You know, the cold spikes when you have especially older people and younger people who can't live in adequately kind of heated homes, it lowers, you know, the lifespan and increases things like the asthma and so on. So, you know, I see the kind of imperative for transitioning our energy system as really high in the buildings, but I also see it as a really, really challenging sector to transition. To be honest, I feel a lot more kind of confident about transport and about the power sector. I don't know, there's fewer actors involved. And, you know, for me, electric vehicles and, you know, public and transport and so on, they're just so obvious and easy, maybe in my head only. that it seems more straightforward. But, you know, with the building sector, you're talking about 2 million individual houses, each of which has its idiosyncrasies, is, you know, and people who might not have the finance or kind of desire to change. You know, the government can't just come in and retrofit a house. And also the variety of solutions that are required depend on the house and the kind of the political environment as well. Because if we were sort of very good at local governance and collective action, you might say that we should be going for district heating on a massive scale. And a lot of European countries have this. They just literally have heat produced centrally. And often it's from a waste source like a power plant or industry, or in our case, it could be a data center, or simply from a centralized boiler or heat pump, or even stored heat from excess wind and solar. That would require a lot of sort of political will at the local level. You'd be talking about digging up streets and kind of insisting that every house in a region, in a district, kind of changes its heating system. And in Denmark, for example, you know, there's local heating plans, and they just say, well, this area will be electric and this area will be district heating. And there's not really a choice in the matter. And I just don't think that we have the sort of political environment that would facilitate that. I hope that we would, but I'm not that optimistic. And then the individualized solution is mainly, the solution is going to be heat pumps, which are, if anyone doesn't know what the technology is, it's essentially where you take one unit of energy in the form of electricity, and the heat pump basically uses that electricity to extract heat from outside, from either the air or the water, from the ground, and it sort of centralizes that heat. It kind of it pumps that heat inside. It's basically like a refrigerator in reverse. So you get three or four units of heat depending on the circumstances. Whereas if you use electricity to directly kind of use a fan heater, you get one unit of electricity in and one unit of heat out. So you get basically four times the energy, three to four times the energy from a heat pump. The tricky thing is that they typically work most, they do work most efficiently in well-insulated homes. So some homes need kind of some upgrades to make them work well. Question is whether we're being kind of overcautious in terms of our kind of over-engineering the retrofit thing. I think, you know, the need for retrofit puts off a lot of people. It's very disruptive internally, which is probably the most thing, this hassle factor. You know, I think some homes, they would have the finance to do retrofit, but it's the headspace. You know, I think maybe this is a reflection on my own life, that we have an oil heated house. I can't wait to get off oil, but I just don't have the headspace to plan it, to call people to figure it out and so on. And there's the various conflicting information as well, where the solar panels are quite straightforward. It's a day's work. There's no internal or the minimal internal disruption. And same with an electric car. You know, you don't need a huge amount of planning, I suppose, to think about that. So, my kind of gut feeling is that heat pumps will be the main way we'll decarbonize buildings. I can understand why they're being cautious in terms of not wanting to put heat pumps into kind of poorly insulated buildings, in case you know, you get a lot of homeowners unhappy with the heat pump and that with maybe higher energy bills and you know, not being as warm as they wanted. You know, those kinds of experiences can turn off and delay a transition very, very rapidly. So it's a careful balance between kind of urgency, kind of doing these things quickly and maybe not to the 100% perfection, versus doing it right. And so it's going to be a major challenge.
Yeah. Okay. And you touched on transport a couple of times as well, Hannah. We use an awful lot of fossil fuels in this sector, 94%. And you know, we're still a long way to go here as well. Transport emissions, unfortunately, in Ireland have gone back to pre-pandemic levels. But I read a brilliant blog by yourself, Hannah, Commuting Choices, it's called. It was written this year. And, you know, you kind of outlined some of the challenges for your busy rural households to try and travel as sustainably as possible. I'm just wondering, could you outline some of the main challenges and, more importantly, solutions for sustainable travel as you see it at national and local level?
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad someone reads my blog. It's not very frequently updated, but yeah, I think like my case, especially since I've had kids and the kids are now in kind of preschool and primary school, I think like some of the typical challenges that people face, that households face, are becoming really clear to me. Because, you know, before you have kids, it's a lot easier to, you know, to build your life around, let's say, cycling or taking a bus. The main challenges that we really face are our legacy of our dispersed planning, or lack of planning. To be honest, I would have preferred to have, you know, built a modern house in kind of the edge of a village, so my kids could walk to school, and, you know, I could get a bus to the city. But for whatever reason, that's not possible to do in this country. And there's very, you know, villages are not, and small towns are not particularly livable. And then that's because they're very traffic heavy. There's no public realm because all the public realm is dedicated to parking and so on. It's an unpleasant space. So you've got this self-perpetuating loop that, to have kind of a nice, peaceful life and some space, some green space, people go out and they build, or they kind of renovate a rural house, which is basically what we did, against what I would have preferred. And then they themselves become car dependent and, you know, drive into the city and make the city less pleasant to live. And you've got this horrible kind of spiral towards car dependency. And that's what we have. We've got a massively car dependent society. And to reverse that, you need very kind of brave and dedicated policy making, which reverses that. I see a lot of low hanging fruit here. And one thing I've been trying to bang a drum about is school transport. So I was recently in New York City for a conference, and even in New York, where they have public transport, where they have, you know, dedicated cycle lanes, you saw these yellow school buses every morning, every afternoon, on every street, and kids, you know, using these school buses. And here, school buses, a fairly small proportion of students take them, because they, you know, a lot of students are not, don't qualify for a space because maybe they live within 4 kilometers of school, or the bus just simply doesn't go past their house. So that means, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but now, you know, basically most children are driven to school, and far fewer walk, cycle, or take the bus than they would have before. And again, that creates the self-perpetuating loop that, you know, if parents have to drive their kids to school, then they'll end up driving to work because, you know, they're not going to drive home and then sort of cycle to work, or kind of drive home and then get the bus to work, you know. So that kind of promotes, it kind of limits the active travel or sustainable travel choices that that the commuters can take then. It also creates a kind of a car dependent environment around schools, so that, you know, it's unpleasant for students to walk. You know, something that it was Tara Shine, who's a famous, you know, who's a very well-known kind of climate communicator and climate person. Our kids actually go to the same school in Kinsale, and she's pointed out that most of the schools in Kinsale and Cork, the primary schools, don't have footpaths connecting them to the town. I mean, that is mind-boggling. This is not like sophisticated technology that we need. We simply need footpaths and road space for kids to safely be able to go to the school. So, I mean, I was talking to one mum from a local primary school where there's, again, no footpath, even though it's within 0.5 kilometre of a local housing estate where lots of the kids would come from. And she said it's only a matter of time before a child is killed on the road because they're still walking to school and there's no footpath. I mean, who are in charge of school buses? It's a very creaky system. They should be far more agile, putting a lot more money into this, you know, buying. Can you imagine sort of lots of electrics, maybe small mini buses, a whole network of them, loads of them around the country, kind of agile, picking up kids. And then, you know, maybe doing loops to the GAA field. And, you know, we have the technology to make this happen. And because families, you know, don't have any alternatives, most families are locked into needing 2 cars, which is very expensive. You know, cars are the greatest expense that families have, typically after their mortgage and maybe childcare. So, we just need to plan things a lot better. And the institutions involved are being far too slow in delivering on that. Even, the active travel expenditure that the Department of Transport has managed to get into the budget, it's even being unspent. This is not a matter of not there not being enough money for these schemes. It is a lack of institutional will to drive these things. And I think we need to start pointing the finger a lot more at these at local authorities and the sort of planning system that is preventing that is locking in car dependency with all the various ills that goes with that. Now, I managed to talk about sustainable transport without once mentioning electric vehicles, which I'm proud about. But I will say that electric vehicles do need to be a kind of a part of the solution as well. We're never going to go kind of completely beyond cars, even though it would be nice to think that we would. I think that, the ideal system would be maybe that a lot of rural households would, with the right public transport in place, would be able to move to a single car household and then have an EV, charge from their solar panels or at a cheap night meter, which would bring down their bills massively, and then I think we should be aiming for car-free cities and towns as quickly as possible. But that's just the it seems like the momentum on that is far too slow so far, but hopefully we're slowly turning the ship around on that.
So Hannah, what are a lot of the longer term solutions for households, such as retrofitting, heat pumps? I have one myself actually, and it's been going great so far, touch wood. But those types of things like insulation, solar panel PVs, it's probably beyond a lot of people at the moment for different reasons. So I'm just wondering, what kind of things could people do right now to reduce at least somewhat their energy bills?
Mm-hmm. I think the first thing that anyone should be doing is the basic insulation. And while we tend to emphasize a lot the high cost of deep retrofitting, actually doing those basic insulation measures, if you haven't had good loft, like attic insulation, look at your windows. I actually have some guys in this morning replacing hinges on some of my windows, which is quite cheap because literally there's air blowing through a lot of those windows and I can feel the heat leaking out of the house. A simple thing like replacing any old incandescent light bulbs with LEDs. The payback time on these kind of basic quick measures is, measured in now months, maybe even weeks rather than years. And for the kind of attic insulation and these sort of shallower retrofit measures that can bring down energy bills and increase comfort inside, the government, I think, provides up to 80% funding for that. So this is a kind of a no-brainer for any household. I think a big challenge also is in our rental stock, and we don't think about renters enough because, a renter isn't going to go installing better hinges on their houses or adding insulation. I think that they're very, and you mentioned the housing crisis as well. So renters are really stuck between a rock and a hard place here. They have no control over the kind of housing quality, and we need to really put a lot more onus on landlords to improve the BER rating of the houses of the rental houses, or punish them in the pocket if they're not. But yeah, I think all the things that you mentioned, eventually, deep retrofitting for households, like some houses that maybe are in the that were built in maybe the thousands or within the last 15 years, they probably could install a heat pump with very little kind of upgrades and I think we'll need to look at those types of houses, to look at houses that are heat pump ready. Hopefully the Climate Action Plan will have some measures like that, a fossil fuel boiler kind of scrappage scheme, for example, to make it a lot easier. But I think we're going in the right direction with the retrofitting. It's just one of those things where we have a large, really big legacy issue, and we need to build up the expertise in the installation and building sector to give people confidence and the kind of skills to be able to do this.
Yeah, brilliant. So just we're nearly coming to the end now, unfortunately, Hannah. But I'm just wondering, what is your vision for the future? And if possible, how can listeners help achieve that vision, both today and in the midterm? And maybe you could include something on the work you and your team have been doing on developing a new low energy demand scenario.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things I touched upon are kind of part of that vision. And like, I get real hope from this idea of this transitioning to like a completely clean energy system. I think that the number of benefits that will bring are huge. To be generating all of our energy kind of in the country itself. a lot of people can get behind this, but there's a big knowledge gap. You know, what's driving our emissions? What's the source of our energy insecurity? There's a lot of misinformation out there, often by parties that are, you know, don't have people's best interests at heart. So I suppose my hope is for a far more kind of engaged public, well-informed public, and kind of activist as well, kind of people who are really asking and driving the change, because, you know, politicians think that these things will be unpopular. People, they keep kind of talking about this, you know, the struggle with bringing people on board with climate action. But they, I think once they start to do a better job of communicating the benefits of all what this energy transition will bring, not just the energy system, but also a clean food system and kind of a nature restored in the country, I think people really can get behind that. I can't go away without saying this thing that I only understood in the last year or two, that Ireland's native ecosystem is rainforest. It's just astounding to me that that's not better known, and that I never knew that. And if we allowed that to come back, we could have rainforest on this island. What a beautiful vision of the future that would be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Are you reading Owen Dalton's, or have you read Owen Dalton's?
I am, yeah, yeah. I'm nearly finished it, and it's just astounding. Also, I'd recommend George Monbiot's Regenesis, which was very transformative to me to think about how we can move our food system to beyond, you know, the really carbon intensive system that we have now based on animals. You know, all these things are really possible, and I have great hope. But I think it's just about, you know, that social tipping point, I think, which can happen very quickly. You know, it takes a lot, like it takes a long time to build infrastructure and stuff. But you can actually get people to change their minds very quickly. And you talked about your neighbors being surprised about solar panels. I think like as soon as, you know, 5% of households have solar panels and people start cycling more, there'll be just a tipping point where people will, it'll become a no-brainer. It'll be like, we'll see kind of fossil fuel-based society and kind of, you know, and you know, heavily exploited land, hopefully in 10 years' time, like we now see smoking inside, you know, like, how could we have done that? It's so polluting, so, you know, so expensive and nasty. And I hope, I think that drives me on, this idea that everybody will see that soon.
Hannah, same here, absolutely. Like, and just looking at the other social movements in the past as well, you know, and how they all of a sudden, you know, become no-brainers, it definitely gives us all hope. So Hannah, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been wonderful chatting with you and hearing all your brilliant insights. So just before we wrap up, if people want to find out more about your work, where can they find it?
Yeah, I think the best place is in my website, hannahdaly.ie, where I post all of my various media articles. So including my Irish Times blog. You know, I do of course have academic papers, but those wouldn't be as interest to the general reading populace.
Brilliant. Listen, Hannah, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be keeping an eye on all your amazing work. So
thanks
so much,
Gary,
for all that you do, and thanks for joining us today.
Bye now.
Hannah shared a vision of a post-fossil fuel society where we have stable and predictable prices for our energy. That renewable energy will give us a clean and healthy society with more money staying in our economy and more jobs created locally too. The vision of electric minibuses whizzing around the country, dropping students and sports teams off, is a great one, I think. And most of the solutions we need for a post-fossil fuel society are already out there. But as Hannah says, we just need the political will. So maybe next time you're talking to a politician, you could share your vision for a sustainable future with them, for more Irish renewable energy and all of the benefits that would bring. So until the next time, thanks for listening and all the best.
Thanks for listening. We hope you got something from today. Don't forget, if you did enjoy this episode, please do tell your friends and subscribe to this podcast. You can find us on social media, search for Climate Ambassador on Instagram or Facebook, or at climate_ambass on Twitter. And we look forward to chatting more in the next episode.